Hi, welcome to episode 103, and this is one of my favorites in a long time. You meet somebody and you can just tell they're way, way, way smarter than you. That's what happened with this, because Dave Haywood came over to the house, and I'd never met Dave in any personal way. We've met many times with the band, but Dave's always the quiet one, and we talk about that on the podcast. But I hope you enjoyed this one as much as I did, and I kind of want to be Dave's best friend now, and I think that's where I'll leave it. I do want to say before we get started, though, you should check out Jake Owen's podcast. It's called Good Company with Jake Owen. He just did one with his dad, so search that. Christian Bush has one called Geeking Out. And the Whiskey Riff guys have Whiskey Riff Raff. They're basically big country music fans, and they talk about it from that perspective. So all that being said, looking for a new podcast, check those shows out. But I think now we'll go into Dave Haywood from Lady Antebellum. The fun fact is, I don't think we get mentioned. We're going to talk about his height, right, in the interview?
No.
Dave's 6'2", so he's just a bit taller than I am. But if you look at a picture of Lady Antebellum, he's tiny. He looks like he's 5'5", because Charles Kelly's 6'7". So here we go, Dave Haywood. Here we go. Thanks for listening to the Bobbycast. All right, welcome to the episode with Dave Haywood from Lady Antebellum. You're like the unicorn, man. You're like the magical unicorn. I've never had a one-on-one interaction with you. You're the one of the three of you guys.
Are you nervous?
Well, a bit. I was a little anxious before you came over because I was talking to Mike. He said, hey, Mike, who produces this, he said, hey, you want to get Lady A? I said, I want to get Dave.
Oh, look at that, man. I appreciate that.
Because
some Dave love.
I've worked
There's a small but mighty fan club of us out there.
I don't know if I'm in it yet. I've worked with Charles. Yeah. But we did some of the shot together, that golf show. I mean, obviously, I know you guys from the superficial, hey, come in, give you a half a hug and talk about whatever project.
Right.
You know, that whole part of it.
Right.
I know Hillary when she was doing her solo stuff, and we did some stuff. But never have you and I just been...
Yeah.
The conversation you and I just had was the only one-on-one conversation we've ever had.
It's nice.
And again, like, you're the unicorn.
This is my first podcast ever.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
Oh, you'll enjoy it because you get to stretch out a bit.
Yeah, I know. I like it. I was telling my wife, I was like, it's going to be nice to just kind of chat and not know you only have 2 minutes, you know, and you got to roll.
Even for me, doing the radio thing, it's... And I get to talk longer than most shows.
Right.
I have a little room because my audience, they know what to expect.
Right.
But even then, it's 7 minutes.
Right.
Bam, bam,
right,
bam, bam.
Right.
You know, get the points out. Make a funny joke.
Right.
Get in.
Right.
Let Charles say something obnoxious. All right. Let Hillary say something sweet. Then Dave says something really smart, and you're like, did you just move on because you don't really know what he just said because it's too musical? So I'm glad you came in.
Thank you for having me.
So I went to the dentist today.
Okay.
And I bring this up to you because your dad basically invented teeth whitening.
Essentially.
Okay.
Yeah.
I went to the dentist today. And so when I started to be somewhat successful, I got new teeth.
Oh, you did? Nice.
Because I never had braces. I couldn't afford braces as a kid.
Right.
And so I got these four and five on the bottom. Yeah. Really crooked.
Yeah.
I went today, right? And I broke one of them.
Oh.
And they replaced it. It was the wrong color. They gave me the wrong color tooth.
Wait, like the wrong shade of white?
Yeah. It was like gray. And so I went in. They took the temporary off, put the new one on, didn't match, took it back off, put the temporary back on, sent me home.
What?
Yeah. Hour and a half, and there's a little pain, and nothing happened today except they said, oop, we put the wrong color. What do you think about
that?
Did
they not match it?
No.
I mean, they did
when it was in my mouth.
Yeah.
But they called the lab to try to get it fixed the same day, and that
doesn't
happen.
Did you get to approve it or not? Normally, they show you the color to make sure that you can see it to, like, approve it.
The hygienist said, you're not going to like this. She said they sent the wrong color.
Oh, no.
Mm.
Wow.
So your thoughts as an expert tooth person?
I don't know if I'm an expert tooth person. My dad wanted me to be a dentist growing up.
Was that the thing?
But I don't, you know, it's funny. I just didn't like hands and mouth, and it's just kind of a gross area to me. But how have you liked it? How's it worked out for you?
Which part of it?
The veneers.
Oh, I mean, excellent.
Yeah?
Yeah. I've had a lot of oral issues because I never went to the dentist in my 20s, period.
Yeah.
So I love them, and I went to, do you know Caroline Cutbirth?
Yeah, yeah.
So her dad is in Waco, Texas, and is... Like,
oh, my dad knows her dad.
So, yes. So I went to him because I trusted him. I'm so scared of the mouth.
Yep.
And so I love them, actually. And
they look great.
Thanks. Yeah. I'm really proud of them.
And you don't have to whiten them. My dad did the teeth whitening, so that was his kind of thing.
So
he helped write the first article on teeth whitening in the early 80s. He was doing a research grant at UNC, North Carolina in Chapel Hill, where we used to live, which I always leave out of the story because I was mostly in Augusta, Georgia for most of my life. But in UNC, my dad was doing a research grant and researching teeth whitening and wrote the first article in the world about, this is just nerd talk, but
That's what a podcast is for, by the way. As nerdy as
good. All right, good. So my dad wrote the first article in the world on using carbamide peroxide, which you put in the tray and you sleep in at night. To try to whiten your teeth. So he wrote the first article on that in the world in the early 80s. And so people kind of coined him like the grandfather of teeth whitening. And so he speaks on it all around the world. A lot of the rest of the world is a lot farther behind in dental work than America is. So he speaks a lot. A majority of his time is around the world, all over the place. I mean, through Russia and Australia and Japan.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, he like travels more than we do in the band.
So your dad teaches school.
So he teaches, he teaches like sophomores and juniors because he loves teaching.
In college.
In the dental program, in dental school. So after college for their master's in dentistry and stuff. So he teaches and then he does research on teeth whitening and speaks. And then he also sees some general patients. So,
would he have liked you to be a dentist?
He wanted me to be. I mean, he would bring home little exercises that his students would do when I was young, where you have to work with chalk and work with your hands and like form things. And I tried it a few times. I just wasn't any good at it. But it's just kind of gross to me.
Yeah, it's gross to me too.
But my dad, I will say, so to give my dad credit, the reason he loves dentistry is because this sounds cheesy, but he does love to make people happy and make people smile. So at the core of it, he does it because he loves making other people happy. And when you go in, you get everything done, and then you like look in the mirror for the first time, you feel great about yourself.
Oh, so I do. It's changed my confidence level.
Yeah,
is 2 points higher because my teeth are better.
Right, and that's what he believes in. I mean, he really is like as gross as being in the dental chair is, and always somebody's over you trying to talk and all that stuff. He loves it because when people walk out, they smile and they're happy, and their confidence level goes through the roof. So
he's academic.
Yeah.
Do you think a bit genetically that's why you are academic musically?
I think so.
Yeah. Do you see that same trait where he associates himself with that you're doing in music?
I think that's a good point. Yeah.
Has anyone ever made that point?
No one's. I know.
Yes. we have a breakthrough.
Coming over here, I was like, is this going to be like my counseling sessions where like,
people have cried in that chair.
Really?
And they didn't think they were going to. with Robert Eaton?
Of course.
Yeah.
Really?
Robert and I got real. Yeah.
He's a heartfelt guy. It's a great point. It's a good point, Bobby. I mean, people that really come from that place of like, I want to do something that matters. And even though you wouldn't think, like, it's just dentistry, it's just teeth, to my dad it matters because it does give people confidence. And I know Robert shares so much of that.
He's passionate.
He's really passionate.
I love that dude.
You know, like, he's always moving and shaking for the TV shows and the award shows and the festivals that he's doing. But, man, at the core of it, he is just, I mean, that Carrie Underwood moment that happened at the CMAs, all these things were just, I mean, that's what he lives for, is to make people feel great in that.
So when were you starting to go, I think I'm pretty good at music then?
I mean, growing up, I mean, probably age 10, 12.
Were you advanced quickly?
I mean, the guitar came really easy. And again, my dad always explained to me, he's like, you know what a talent is, right? I was like, no. He's like, when it actually comes to you really easily. And I was like, but it doesn't feel like a talent because it's easy. And he's like, well, that means you're talented at it. I was like, oh, I guess I'm talented at guitar. It just came naturally and easy. And coming up with chord progressions and coming up with... I would just use some basic recording software, which was a cassette tape that had multi-tracks on it. And I would record like 4-track instrumental little jams, and I'd just play them in the kitchen for my mom all the time. With drums, I had a drum machine and bass and guitars and mandolin, and I just kind of make these little instrumental things. And that was fun, and that was easy, and I felt like I came alive in that process. So that's when I got really into recording, playing guitar. I mean, I was probably 12, 13 years old.
Who put all that in front of you? Because someone had to say, here's a guitar, here's how to run a 4-track.
Yeah, my dad gave me the first guitar, and he plays banjo and guitar. My mom plays piano. And I really learned, it was a lot from them. We had a music room, just like a room, kind of like this, but all instruments lining the walls. And once it was in front of me, I loved learning instruments. And again, it just came naturally. And it was fun to figure out, when I figured out the mandolin, and figured out the bass and all these things. My dad taught me the core of guitar and my mom taught me the core of piano. But kind of it's branched off into a lot of different instruments, and then recording, I just fell in love with the cassette tape, recording, adding something on top, adding something else. I mean, nowadays, the software is insane. You can do that a million times. But back then, you really had to work hard to kind of navigate recording multiple tracks. So,
did you want to be on a stage, or did you want to create from behind?
I didn't want to be on a stage. I honestly would say when I set out, it was the love of creating music. The studio and songwriting, I would say I'd hang my hat on songwriting and producing. Or being creative in the studio.
Did you find the formula to songwriting would come to you pretty easy too?
Yeah, I mean, it just made sense in like a way that's... It's hard to describe. I mean, it's hard to describe what I hear when I have an idea, I guess. You know, like if somebody were to say, we need a song for... I mean, when we wrote Love Don't Live Here... Actually, nobody probably ever knows this, which we can get deep, I guess. When we wrote Love Don't Live Here, we had heard that... Harley Davidson was looking for a theme song. And so Josh Kelly, Charles's brother, told us, he's like, dude, Harley Davidson's looking for a riff for their theme song. And I was like, ooh, I know. I got some great ideas. I bet I can come up with a riff for something. And we went through a bunch of riffs. And then the riff that we settled on ended up being something we kept for ourselves, which was Love Don't Live Here. The very opening guitar riff of Love Don't Live Here, which is the first song we ever put out as Lady Antebellum. But I don't know. I don't know. When I hear songwriting, to me, I feel like if you give me an idea or say, man, we need a, let's write about this. Let's write about this mood. Let's write about this vibe.
I got it right here, baby.
Man, that was quick.
Forgetting all the love we once knew. Girl, I ain't the one. That's the first song? That's the very first song?
Very first song.
You wrote it for Harley and kept it for yourself.
That's right.
That.
But yeah, that guitar riff, you know, coming up with that. I mean, that brings back good memories. It was the old Paul Worley days, man. He is such a cat in studio. I haven't heard that in a while.
Do you think of guys whenever you were coming up and think of them in the studio? Like you talk about Paul Worley.
Yeah.
How much of him did you watch and study because that's what you were really into?
Yeah, so that was what I was really into. So Dan Huff, Paul Worley.
We had Dan Huff on one of these.
Really?
Mind blown. The whole thing, I was just staring at him.
Oh,
it's so, you should, if you ever go back and listen to podcasts, listen to the Dan Huff one of
I
these.
Will.
All it is me fangirling for an hour. Here's me every question. You did that too? That's every question to the Dan Huff.
God, he's got a resume. But that production, I mean, Mark Bright, I mean, the first Carrie record was sick. But Dan Huff, Mark Bright, Paul Worley, and even Ed Cash. I don't know if you know Ed Cash. He produced Dave Barnes, a lot of his records. But so, yeah, those guys are kind of, to me, my unsung heroes.
And you would watch them.
And I would read all the liner notes. I would do everything you could to understand what in the world is Paul Worley doing on that Dixie Chicks record. Like, how does he get that? Like, who came up with that? Who came up with the fiddle on Cowboy Take Me Away? Who came up with that? You know, that was what blew my mind, was the production, the musicians, and, of course, the songwriting. So, yeah, I mean, to go back to your original question... Did I move to Nashville to be under the bright lights and be in the middle of the stage? It's a great, amazing perk of what we get to do. But I would say what I cut my teeth on in my core and my love, my absolute love, I can stay up all night long sitting in the studio working on stuff.
The dynamic of the group works because of that. Charles is big and loud.
Of course.
And he is a made front man.
Yeah, of course.
Hillary... Not as big and loud, but great singer.
Heart.
Yes. Passionate.
Passionate.
They would have made it themselves.
Right.
Equally, if you guys never formed.
Right.
Another frontman wouldn't have worked.
Right.
I hope that's fair to say.
No, fair to say for sure. What I've come to find out over the years, I've recently been diving into the Enneagram in podcasts, if you've heard of that personality test, but... There's a beautiful way that our personalities mix and match. I mean, it's really beautiful. I mean, there's no other way you could have orchestrated it. I mean, I the way me and Charles started, the way we met her, and we are three completely different personalities, but it just works.
To be fair, I would say you are the front man in the studio. I'd say it's a different, it's like a triangle.
Well, we each have our roles,
shifts,
kind of.
Yes.
The way we say it a lot is we each have our roles, I think. And... Charles is so great live. I mean, so great live. I mean, when we were in middle school, we'd be sitting. I mean, I played guitar in a band. And so Charles would like come up on stage like he does now, you know, when he was always like, dude, let me come up on stage and sing. So he'd come up on stage in middle school and do the same thing. And we'd play Mustang Sally or play a James Brown song. And he would just light the room up, and he's 11 years old. I'm like, how do you do that? You know, because I'd be back there playing all the parts and doing stuff. And he's amazing live. And I think Hillary, like you said, is such an amazing, passionate, heartfelt person and wears her heart on her sleeve, and people connect with it, and they connect with her so much. And then what I will take to my grave is I just am obsessed with songwriting and production. And so it's just this beautiful kind of triangle of the way things that are married in our group. It's
really
neat.
When you go into the studio, are you the boss of the group?
I mean, I would say they look to me for like, hey, what do you think we should do? I mean, there's always a producer there too, but what I know us, and I know what we'll do, really. The producer is helpful to kind of push us, but I think at the end of the day, I'm like, man, we should add strings to this. I really don't think we should. That guitar riff's just too cheesy for us. We wouldn't do that. Let me try coming up with something myself. I think they look to me musically for where we go and dynamically, and I just know what I can hear that we're talking about. You know, a lot of times you kind of have banter of like, man, it just doesn't feel right. It just doesn't feel right. Dave, what are we trying to articulate here? It's like, dynamically, this isn't happening. How do we make this happen in the studio? Is that getting really deep and too nerdy?
No, I think it's actually not nerdy enough. Here, let me talk about this for a second. It's fitting that I do this show from my house because Blue Apron also comes to my house. And when I talk about them during the podcast here, it's basically downstairs. And Blue Apron delivers fresh, pre-portioned ingredients, step-by-step recipes right to your door that you can cook in under 45 minutes. The menu changes every week based on what's in season, what's designed by the Blue Apron in-house culinary team. Blue Apron offers 12 new recipes every week, and you can pick 2, 3, 4 recipes, whatever you want, based on your schedule. It comes right to the door. Super convenient. And again, there's a card that tells you how to make the meal. Listen, I'm no chef, but you would think I was after you eat my food that Blue Apron actually set up for me. High quality, too. Things like strip steak and potatoes with spicy maple collard greens. I just had some steak. Do you see my steak downstairs, by the way? Pretty good, huh? Spicy chicken and stir-fried vegetables with jasmine rice. Soy-glazed Korean rice cakes with broccoli and soft-boiled eggs. And creamy fusilli bucati pasta with fried rosemary and walnuts. Blue Apron is hooking you up right now. $30 off your first order if you go blueapron.com/bobbycast. blueapron.com/bobbycast. Blue Apron is a better way to cook. So I remember the first time I heard of you guys. I was doing pop radio, and
really, nice.
Yeah, you guys had come through Austin, and you had just started. When did you guys sign a deal? What year did you sign?
2007. We signed with Capitol.
So I was syndicating a pop. That was what I was doing at the time. I started to build this syndication company, and I remember you guys coming through, and I remember the name Lady Antebellum, which was a weird name the first time you hear it. And I thought, right. Lady, it must be a bunch of girls. Right. So what was the process in naming the band? Because it's a very feminine name.
Right.
And was Hillary thought of, since it's Lady Antebellum, that people are going to assume that she's Antebellum? Was that a thing where everyone kept calling?
To this day, we will walk in a venue. I mean, literally to this day. I mean, we were just on an arena tour, right? Backstage at Bridgestone, I heard a security guard say, well, what time does the lady get here? And I was like, wow. You know, it's just, it really, it's great humble pie. But yeah, I mean, the process of us coming up with it was just, it was so small, and it didn't feel like it would be anything that stuck, because we were just trying to come up with something weird enough to get people's attention. Because that was back in the MySpace days, and, you know, people are probably tuning out, what is MySpace? But, you know, we had all of our music up on MySpace, and we were trying to just come up with kind of a wacky name, like as clickbait, you know, like where somebody's like, come, they're like, what in the world is that? Lady in a Mountain. So that was kind of the goal, was to come up with something so weird people would click on it. And, I mean, we came up with it taking pictures in front of some old homes in Franklin. We drove out a little bit past Cool Springs where we were and took some photos in front of these old kind of mansions and stuff out there. Beautiful antebellum homes.
That you couldn't own yet. But
that,
one
that
day.
We couldn't own
one
yet. But yeah, beautiful antebellum homes. We were talking about how, man, these homes are really neat, and they're such cool antebellum homes. And we're like, well, that could be a band name, Antebellum. And then Charles was like, what about the ghost of the Lady Antebellum? Like, there's a lady that lives in the house in the antebellum home, the Lady of Antebellum. And we were like, man, that's so, what was the band we referenced? Like Saving Jane, you know, like kind of a feminine leaning name, but with like two bearded hairy guys. you know, and, you know, dueling lead vocals and different styles musically. It just was all, I don't know, it happened really organically.
Was it always thought of as dueling lead vocals with mm-hmm. those? Yeah.
From the very beginning. So the first song we wrote ever was a song called All We'd Ever Need, which was not a single. But I remember we wrote it, we were trying to get on Hillary's bandwagon. So speaking of Hillary being able to make it on her own, Charles and I were like, you know what? We're riding her coattails all the way to the bank and to the... We were like, she's going to make it, man. She's huge. Her voice was insane. And so we were trying to write songs for her. And the first song we wrote was called All We'd Ever Need. And it was off Hillary singing the lead vocal. And we were writing it and she was like, God, I just think, Charles, you should sing. You've got a great voice. I think you should sing lead on the second verse and kind of enter as like the second, you know, the male partner from a story writing perspective. And so once we had the both vocals in there, it was like, well, this feels really cool and different. But we're like, you can't have two vocalists. You can't have two vocalists in a band. So it's not going to work, but this is really interesting. Maybe we'll pitch it to Garth and Trisha or Tim and Faith or somebody doing a duets record. But sure enough, we started writing more duets and then more kind of Hillary leads, Charles lead, and of course, a lot of three-part harmony all over the place. So it was very, again, organic and the way it all evolved and happened naturally. I mean, early on radio, I mean, they told us to our face, they're like, you know, we like you guys, but it's not going to work. You can't have two singers. You can't have two lead singers. Nobody, everyone's going to get confused. And we would reference, you know, Fleetwood Mac and the Eagles. I mean, all these bands that had multiple people singing lead.
Eagles had many lead singers.
All of them. I mean, Timothy B. Schmidt is my favorite Eagles member. Just with his voice, you know.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean, it's, you know, people said, like, man, I don't think it's going to work. And, you know, we were like, we stuck to our guns. It felt organic and it felt, that's who we were.
It's crazy, too, the organicness of just you and Charles actually knowing each other for that long. Much less having a working relationship, a friendship.
Right.
Because you brought up the fact that, you know, middle school.
Right.
To have two people that are that talented, though, even in a small town.
Yeah.
Just as weird. It's almost the outlier effect too, where you had two people that love the same thing whose personalities happened to work compatible. Then you came to town. The odds of that happening are crazy.
It is. I mean, and Charles was like the only person. That's funny you bring that up. You bring up good points. I mean, I just remember being in Augusta thinking, I hear music so different. When I hear the radio and I hear songs, I hear production, I can't even articulate what goes on in my head. There's a bazillion things for every track I hear. And I was like, no one else understands that. But then when I met Charles and we started to kind of do some writing and played in bands and did, I was like, he gets it, man. Like, I think he here, and when we started writing together in college at University of Georgia, I was like, okay, we're on the same wavelength. And it is rare. I mean, to both come out of the same town, the creative brain is just it's a weird thing to explain. You know, I know people are always like, how do you write songs? How do you come up with ideas? How do you do stuff? And it's hard.
I think of like asking, how do you run fast?
I mean, which I can't do.
Well, I don't know how fast you run, but it's for me, you know, how do you think quick?
Yeah.
Like God has gifted me with a talent and I've learned how to take this talent and put it into the tunnel.
Right.
And drill it down.
Yeah.
But I think we all have something that we're naturally good at.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of a talent. Again, like my dad told me, I didn't get what a talent was. I didn't see it because it came easy to me. I figured a talent was like something you really had to like, I hope this doesn't sound backwards, but you know, like something you had to work really hard. Like I wanted to play sports. I just was not good at sports, any of them really. And I'd wanted so bad to be talented at sports, but I just wasn't. But music was just easy. I was like, well, that's easy. I know exactly what a song can come on the radio. I can mostly tell you what key it's in.
So you could hear the key.
Yeah, pretty much. That came off more. That sounded really pretentious as I said it. But knowing guitar so well, I just know what chords they're playing.
The thing about podcasts, most listeners are pretentious. So we're all good. We're all in the same pretentious room together.
This is an elite group.
Anyone's listening to this is elite.
If they've made it the 30 minutes in already, then they're even more elite.
So you jokingly said that you and Charles were going to ride Hillary's coattails. And I don't use the same term, but when you and Charles came to town, did you just want to write for Charles and play for Charles?
I did. So when we got to town, we were doing pop music.
You moved to Nashville to do pop music.
I moved to Nashville to write music. This is, I love it going back, man. We moved to Nashville because of Josh Kelly. So Charles has an older brother, Josh Kelly, who had a big pop song called Amazing, which was huge in 2003, I think. And so he bought a house in Cool Springs and said, dude, you guys, man, he's so nice. He's so kind. He said, y'all come to Nashville, man. You guys have the talent. Like, come and just try to write music. So me and Charles moved into his house in Cool Springs together under the goal of just writing songs. We wanted to be songwriters. Once we got there, Charles and I started to write songs together a lot and made a CD under his name, two CDs under his name at the home studio there. And so, yeah, I mean, we were doing pop stuff under Charles's name, and we'd travel all around and play coffee shops and really small places.
Who was in your class of moving to Nashville? Because it seems everybody has a class, and they all moved at the same time, and they were...
Ours was around Luke. I remember because we were from Georgia. So I remember a bunch of my friends from Georgia Southern, you know, we were going to move to Nashville, and they're like, dude, there's this country guy, you know, Luke Bryan, keep an eye out for him. He got a record deal about a year before we did, I believe. And I just remember he was in that development deal and record deal around the same time. So kind of the Luke Bryan era, a couple of those people. I mean, Miranda was before us. But yeah, I mean, Luke would be probably our closest, like both at the same record label, both from Georgia, new mutual friends and stuff.
You moved to Nashville, you and Charles, and I get to this in a minute, and you talk about MySpace and how it was such a big part, but you don't even have a Twitter page. Like, social media was such a big part of you guys' story, yet you don't have a Twitter page and just got on Instagram.
Are you talking about me personally?
Yes, Dave Haywood, yeah. Personally. I know you didn't. But again, there's a little bit of beauty to the irony of social media being such a big part of the story of your life and career, and now you just aren't on it, really.
I could talk about this for hours. We could do a whole other podcast on social media for me. I know computer programming really well. That was my major in college, was information systems technology. That sounds really nerdy for all the listeners out there. But I was an MIST major at UGA, and so studied computer programming. So I know backwards and forwards Facebook when it came out and social media and what it does and how it operates. And for a time, I loved being on it. And our band started doing so much on MySpace, and we did these webisodes once a week. I feel like we were one of the first people to really have a camera out a lot and capture a lot of webisodes early on in country music. And so that was our main thing. But for me now, I just kind of pulled back. I mean, just there's kind of this thing that happens with me where my personality type, Enneagram 9 for all the Enneagram listeners out there, my personality type just doesn't do well with tons and tons of exposure and critique with my personal stuff. You know, so for me, just to be completely honest with you, there's just boundaries I have. They're healthy boundaries that I've worked through that are best for me. I'll share once every few weeks what I'm kind of doing with my family. But for me, I have to kind of pull back, and I have to have those boundaries about things that are private between, you know, stuff with our kids and stuff with my wife. I don't know. I there's a beauty in letting people walk through a journey with you. I really think there's a beauty in that. But for me, there's parts of personal life that I just have some boundaries with personally. I don't document every day what I do. I just kind of enjoy, I feel pressure. My personality type feels the pressure to perform. If I have to know that every single day I've got an Insta story, Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and know what I'm doing is really, really awesome every day. My personality type doesn't do well with that kind of performance and pressure on a day-to-day basis. So for me, I do better kind of pulling back and then popping in with like, hey, check this out, we had a baby, or, you know, hey, we're doing this in the studio. But for me, I just kind of enjoy I enjoy that boundary. Is that okay to say?
Yeah, I think any boundary that you set up front is a fair boundary. I think where people get in trouble is if they're posting lots of things, and we'll talk about social media specifically.
Yeah.
They post and they put, and then all of a sudden they demand, no, this is my personal life.
Yeah.
It's
right.
You have to condition people to be conditioned.
Right.
And so if you're setting the boundary, you can live within it. It's what we were talking about, and we won't say who, we were talking about somebody in the media earlier, and we my point about them was they're always consistent, and I enjoy that.
Right, right.
Regardless if I agree with them or not, I just enjoy consistency in humans, in media. I try to give it.
Right.
Sometimes I'm consistently inconsistent, and that's right. even a sort of consistency.
Right, right, right.
Where
Sorry, that took me a second.
So
I got you on that.
With social media, the answer for me is, if that's your rule, then we all play by it.
Right.
Now, if it's your rule, but you change it up, and then you demand other people follow your, then it gets a little squishy.
Right.
I think that's completely fair. I just
right.
saw the irony in
yeah.
MySpace was a big part of Lady Antebellum.
Right.
I can't find you on Twitter.
I'm
like, I can't go at Dave Haywood. I have to go hashtag Dave Haywood. Just some, it's like at Charles Kelly LA, at him, and then hashtag Dave Haywood because he doesn't exist.
I'm in the minority here. I understand that me not being on all social media, I'm in the minority. I get that. And I know I probably sound really old school and people are going to roll their eyes at it. But for me, again, my personality type just has to have time for me to retreat. For me to process things and to live my best life, I have to pull back. And when I go home, I have to not share it that. And I'll give you just a completely candid and personal experience and story about that. End of last year, I hit a little season of anxiety in my life. Some panic attacks. Everything kind of came crashing down for a little bit. And I said a million times to myself, if I had the pressure every day that I would have had to post on social media during that time, it would have broken me down even more. It was just a season of a lot of things. And again, I have boundaries with what I even share, but I want people to know that it's okay to go through those things. For me, I would have been so wrecked if I was going through all this stuff personally and I had to post, today was awesome, today was sick, you know, I just had the best lit breakfast with my bros. Like, I mean, I wasn't. I had a little rough patch of some personal things. So, I don't know. For me, again, it's my personality type that does the best when I can have moments to retreat, process, pull back, and have time for me. I just have to carve out time for me that's not shared, if that's okay.
That anxiety, I was on some crazy anxiety medicine for a long time.
Really?
Because I've never seen
stuff,
anything so
crazy.
And I never thought it was until I actually went through it.
Yeah.
And it felt like an egg coming over me that
yeah.
I couldn't get out of.
Oh, yeah.
Or like, you know when the mime does the hands?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It felt like that was around me.
Yeah.
And I couldn't control it.
Yeah.
And then I got on some medicine that I couldn't get off.
Yeah.
It was a whole thing.
Yeah, absolutely, man. It's, you know, I never fully understood mental health. And I'll be completely honest, and I actually feel like I can empathize now because I was trapped in some deep anxiety and panic attacks for about 3 months. And, man, it sucks. It completely sucks. You feel alone. You feel fear.
Yeah, and you feel
a lot
like
of stuff.
Nobody else can understand.
You feel like nobody understands.
Yeah, that's how I felt.
Yeah.
And people get butterflies, and I get butterflies. But, again, it's if you take a flamethrower of butterflies
yeah.
and shoot them right up your butthole.
Yeah.
That into your body. That's
yeah.
really what it feels
oh,
like.
Oh yeah,
and you, can, yeah.
yeah.
I still have anxiety. I go to therapists all the time.
Yeah, me
I spend
too.
Way too much money in therapy.
You should, man. Counseling is so, it's life changing. It's completely life changing.
For me, it lets me look at me.
Yeah,
that's the hardest
it's a mirror.
Thing I've ever had to.
It's
do.
Like somebody gives you a mirror. They hold a mirror and say, "Well, here's what you're saying. Here's
the
where you are."
Awareness is self awareness.
It is,
and that's my struggle.
It
is looking at myself in a natural way.
Right.
And it's hard, and you don't want to do it sometimes.
Yeah, yeah. It's I'm telling you, it's so worth it. It's been a life changer for me. I mean, I even spent some time at this place called Onsite, which
oh,
is a spiritual growth
no,
place.
I'm like, you brought that up. Listen, you went.
Have
there?
You been?
Okay, let me tell you what happened. Because she's not gonna care. I mentioned this. So.
Oh yeah.
She just went. She said, I'm two different people.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Before, and after.
Yeah.
And I know Miles, the CEO.
Oh, you
of
do.
Onsite.
Yeah.
So
yep.
I did TED. Oh, now we're going down the rabbit hole.
There
you
go. Yeah.
So, because I got so many questions. And so I did a TED Talk. And I did a TED Talk on successful people and how losing and failure is pivotal in success.
Mm-hmm.
And that's counterintuitive to what we see. That we think somebody just goes, hey, I'm good at something, and then they just win at life.
Right.
And that's really not what happens.
Right.
Even the best people struggle.
Right.
And the struggle is what makes them and separates them from the good.
Right.
So I do this TED Talk, and Miles, who runs Onsite,
mm-hmm.
I meet him for the first time. He does it right before me or after me. And I say, hey, because I'm big into therapy. I make jokes, but I'm big into it. It's changed
yeah.
my life.
Yeah. Me too.
So he says, hey, you know, I have this house, and it's right outside of Nashville. You should come check it out. I don't really think anything about it. I'm at a charity event with my co-host, Amy, and I see him again. And I bring it up to him. I say, man, I want to come out there. I need to get away. Did you check your phone?
Yeah, I couldn't use it for...
That's crazy to me. But what
Which was fine because I don't have social media. So there's nothing for me to...
For me, it's just, what if something happens to my dog?
Yeah.
What if something... And I don't have kids or a wife.
There's emergency protocol.
There is?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Part of it scares me so much, I don't even want
to
ask.
You could go to a specific place and say, like, hey, I've got to check on... And they'll be like, okay, so fine.
Really?
They just don't want you to be... What we all do. You walk right out of counseling, you hop back on your email and your text and everything.
That's what I would do. I would live. Yeah. They have TVs?
They don't.
I don't know if I... Dave, I sleep with the TV on it. I sleep with the TV on at night. I never had a bedroom, so I slept on the couch in the living room. The TV stayed on because I lived in the living room.
Right.
I sleep with the TV on, or I get so anxious.
Right.
Because since 9, the TV's been on when I sleep. I can't go somewhere and sleep without a TV.
Mm. Well, maybe you could do like a white noise machine instead.
I did this stuff. Doesn't work. I need to have King of Queens or the Honeymooners.
King of Queens.
Yeah. It's got to be on in the background. I have my...
So you just need like the noise of like Seinfeld happening.
Whatever it is, this is how messed up I have in my head. I have to have already seen the episode. Because if I haven't, I want to know what's going on.
Right.
And I like learning.
Right.
And if it's something that I think I... Because I'll Wikipedia things.
Right.
Just watching TV on my laptop, and I'll just Wikipedia things and learn about them as a show happens.
Right.
Background actors.
Right. Yeah. We're watching The Crown right now, and that's what we're doing too. Dude, it's like
first. That's all I did the first 3 episodes until I trusted it, and then I just went with it.
Right.
But I fact checked every part of The Crown.
Right.
Fantastic. Right.
Right. It's great.
Do you feel like you're learning? Because I did.
I do. I feel like I haven't learned in a long time about history, and it's
I gave
kind
zero
of,
crap about the royal family.
Yeah.
I'm totally invested in his wedding now.
Oh,
too.
Yeah. I know. We're like, well, who's going to be the next this, and who's the next that? You know, going forward. And
were you amazed that Queen Elizabeth was never supposed to be the queen? Like, that blows my mind.
I know.
She wasn't even in line for it.
I know.
And her
We're only
uncle.
Like 4 episodes in, so don't get
Well, no,
too...
but that's the...
Yeah, but I know that's part of history, yes.
No, and that's in the first 4 episodes. That's the first thing. Her uncle was the freaking king.
I know.
He quit because he was dating a Kardashian, basically.
Yeah.
Ah, it's my... Oh, we're here with Dave Haywood, Lady Annabelle. I'm talking about music. Oh, let me talk about this for a second. I'll talk to you about my sleep number bed. Yes, it's probably 10 feet away from me. Probably 30 feet away from me. And so maybe you've considered getting a new bed. You didn't know. Maybe you thought, man, I hear about the sleep number. And I hear about the sleep number setting, but is it for real? I can just tell you my experience and that I've had trouble sleeping. And I still do have trouble sleeping at times. Not because of the bed. You know, my bed, my sleep number has actually improved my quality of sleep. Because I went into the store, and what happens is they say, hey, lay on the bed. And you lay on the bed. And there's a computer screen, and it measures your back, your neck. It says, okay, what if we fix this? And then they give you a sleep number, your setting. Mine's 30. My sleep IQ score last night was in the 90s. Their newest beds are so smart, they sense your moves and automatically adjust. Like, this is real-life bed stuff here. They're using technology to make you sleep better. They cost about the same as traditional mattresses. They last twice as long. 9 out of 10 owners recommend. Go in during their ultimate sleep number event and save 50% on an ultimate limited edition bed. Plus, Queen Mattress Start at $699.99. Sleep Number now has over 500 stores nationwide. Find the one nearest you. Sleepnumber.com/bones. Okay, so we can reset. Let's just reset and go back to our music. Have a drink of water. I get a little too excited about things sometimes, and away we go. You guys just went to New York for the Grammys.
Yeah.
I guess you and Charles did. Hillary just had the baby, so she didn't go.
Yeah.
Was that timing always, this might shoot?
Well, to be honest... I'll have to walk you through it because it was just crazy the way it happened. I mean, we were on the red carpet. Me and Charles went up to New York with our wives for the Grammys, and we have a 4-week-old little girl at home, and so we had to leave her for the day, which we did okay, but really missed her. But we got up there. We're on the red carpet. We're doing interviews and stuff, and we were kind of joking because it's been kind of the timeline of when she's supposed to have – when you have twins, you have them a little early. That's just what happens with twins because there's twice the fun in there. So you have twins early than what your scheduled due date is for space reasons. So anyways, we knew it was going to be sometime soon, but we get off the red carpet or we get done with the show and we go have dinner and we're just group texting. We group text, me, Charles, and Hillary. We like group text all the time. Just like, oh my gosh, you know, how are you feeling? What's going on? Just silly stuff, animated GIFs, the whole 9 yards, just fun group text. And we were texting at 10:30 or 11 and then we all went to bed at midnight or something. And I woke up at 6 to go to the airport, and I had like 10 missed texts. You know, when you wake up and you have like all these missed texts, you're like, oh God, what's going on? Sure enough, she's like, we went to the hospital, blah, blah, blah. We had the babies. I'm like, what? We were texting at 10 o'clock last night and everything. I thought she was like joking about like, you guys are making me laugh with this cardboard cutout that we brought to the Grammys of Hillary. Y'all are making me have contractions and laugh. And I thought she was joking. I was like, were you serious? You must have been serious about contractions. But sure enough, so literally the night of the Grammys, she had the twin girls. And so I haven't met them yet. They've just a few days ago. And so it's awesome. We've been getting some beautiful photos from her and texts and stuff. So, but I'm thrilled for them. That's awesome.
What was the dynamic with, because Hillary's husband, who I know, so I'm talking about people like I don't know them, but yeah. Who I know, like her husband's a drummer.
Right.
How was that whole thing with the band? And there's another influence that's kind of on the inside of the band without actually being the band. Like that dynamic also has to change things up a bit, right?
Of having
her husband.
Oh, just her
drumming. And he's on the inside because he's with Hillary, but he's not really part of the band.
Hey, no one else could do it but him. He's such a team player and such a great. I mean, he's a badass drummer. Let me just go ahead and lead with that. He is in our band because he is one of the best drummers there is. He really is from a technical standpoint. His power, his intuitiveness for where we go on a live show. Again, it works great. I mean, really, it's not like a. There's never been any kind of like a dissension of like, you know, I handle a lot of the band stuff. And so I reach out to him all the time independently of like, hey, we got to go do this rehearsal or.
Are you the band leader?
Our keyboard player is technically our band leader, but I kind of enjoy doing all that stuff and organizing that. I enjoy working with like the TV shows, like when we performed on the ACMs last year. I really enjoyed like working with Rack and working with the producers and UNLV and the horn section. And
yeah, that was really cool when you guys brought out the band.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, that was a really cool moment.
Thank you, man. Thank you.
And it kind of, everybody's eyes got real big.
Yeah.
Because it was loud. Yeah. It's very loud.
Oh God, you should have heard it backstage in a locker room. It was like annoyingly loud, but it was a great moment. But I love doing that stuff. But I mean, Chris has been such an amazing piece to our whole Lady A world. It really, I mean, it all just works. I'm not trying to like just always blow smoke. And I think we've said that plenty of times. I mean, it genuinely works between all of us really, really well.
So you play guitar, you play mandolin. I'm trying to think things I've seen you play.
Piano and guitar, I'd say, are my main two that I enjoy.
But you still play mandolin. I've seen you play mandolin.
Mandolin, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you practice? Do you still have to practice or is it mostly up there?
I don't practice. I mean, I kind of play for fun. But
you ever just grab it at home and play?
Oh, God, all the time.
Oh, so you still enjoy?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have a studio room upstairs, much like this room, just a great kind of home studio room with a full Pro Tools rig and then about 20 guitars and stuff. So, bouzouki, which is like a bigger mandolin, Irish mandolin. And
you play drums?
I can keep a beat decent, yeah. I can keep a beat decent. I mean, a lot of the stuff you do now is programmed, so you like use a little keyboard pad just to like get a kick and snare and.
You ever wake up in the middle of the night and go, have an idea?
Yeah.
And you have to go get it out of your head.
Yeah, I have to go put it down. And a lot of mine are musical, you know. I normally start musically. So for me, it's a lot of like, you know, hear a chord progression or hear a kind of groove or I don't know.
I need you now open. You know, dun, dun, dun. What did that come from?
Mike Rojas came up with that piano part. I have to give him 100% of the credit. But we wrote that with Josh Keir early in our career, and it kind of went in the back pocket for a while. I mean, we wrote it after our first record, which had Love Don't Live Here and Looking for a Good Time, and I Run to You were our first three singles.
Hey, let me hit some of this here. Here we go. Here's like, hey, I'm just looking for a good time. I Run to You. You mentioned
I Run to You. It was on the first record. Yeah. This world keeps spinning
faster. This one tests well. Still gets played a lot.
Yeah,
this
it
still
does.
Still feels current to me.
Yeah.
Even though it was from the first record.
And listen to those lyrics in our society today, man. It's huge. Tom Douglas.
Tom Douglas sat in that chair and blew my mind.
Oh, did he come here?
Oh, yeah. He talked about you guys.
Really?
Yeah, in Gathering Around the Piano.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got a beautiful little farm and our beautiful home out in, you know, Franklin or whatever, and just an old piano, and he's such a poet. He's just so artistic. I'm like, I like want to be him. I would fangirl him just even though we've written with him a dozen times. Like, I would fangirl him just about everything.
Yeah, I've been lucky enough to sit next to some really mind-blowingly awesome people that I only appreciate way later.
Right.
Because in the moment, and that's got to be like that with you at times too. You're doing this big,
right.
The moment, you're just trying to get through it and not suck.
Right.
And then you look back at it and go,
yeah,
that was awesome.
It was so cool. That was a poem, which we've told that story, but our bass player jokes us about that a lot. But it was a poem Tom had written called I Run to You. And it was just all these things that he runs from pessimists and prejudice.
That's right. He told the story, right?
He was actually running, I think, maybe the Music City Marathon. But he had all these visions of things that you run from. I mean, how deep is that? You know, like, I mean, it's like, why can't I think of that kind of stuff? He's just that kind of guy. And has lived a lot of great life and had, you know, his ups and downs that he writes and shares about. But yeah, that started with a poem, and we basically took his poem and kind of put music to it. And then we got into it. So writing for the next record, we had a writing appointment with Josh Keir, and we never written with him before, but he had written Before He Cheats for Carrie Underwood. And we went in there and wrote one song first for about an hour, and it was kind of quick, and it didn't feel like a good song.
An hour. That's a quick write.
It was a quick write. He had like half of it done. It was a song called Young Love, and it just didn't feel like us. It didn't feel like us. And we finished it, and I was like, yeah. And then it was like one of those things. Charles was like, why don't we just stay and write another song? And I was like, I mean, we're all single and have nothing to do. I was like, sounds great. I'm here. So we started writing another song, and Charles had some melodies on the guitar. He had just started playing guitar, actually. And learned a few chords on the acoustic. So he came up with some of the melody on the verse. And then we kind of just sailed off from there. And, we wrote it really quick. I'd say in an hour as well. Wow. Need You Now happened fast. Some songs take like 6 hours or a few days or a couple writing sessions. But Need You Now was quick. I Run to You was pretty quick.
You finished Need You Now and... It's just a song.
It's just a song. I didn't think it would... we sat on it for probably 8 months, just sitting in our iTunes playlist. And our very last label meeting to cut with Paul Worley for that Need You Now record, which it was not obviously titled then. I remember, and again, it's just a beautiful testament, I think, Charles and his memory and his passion and ear for music. He was like, what about that? Remember that song we wrote with Josh Keir that day? You know, it's kind of like... It sounds just like it'd be a cool album track, you know, kind of one of those like kind of insider songs that like people just love the vibe. You know, it could probably have like a cool vibe. What if we, you know, and the acoustic demo, I ought to play you some of that. I mean, the acoustic demo is just, we're fumbling all over the melody. You know, it's like he messes up a lyric and it was just all over the place. The acoustic demo was really just, it was just a voice memo from our phone. And so it sounded really rough, but we were like, a couple of the people in the room, Autumn House, Mike Dungan, they all kind of perked up. They're like, that could be kind of cool. Why don't you guys try that? And so still, we didn't know what was happening. We got in the studio and recorded it. And I think once we got in there and Paul Worley got his hands on it, he made, so the piano part, Mike Rojas was tinkering around, you know, when you're warming up in the studio. And he started to kind of do that on the outro of the song. And we were like, man, do that on the intro. That's like a hook. That sounds like one of those big hooks. The bass line, this guy named Craig Young played that Paul Worley got. I could geek out on these guys' names for hours. But some of the bass playing, piano playing, guitar. I mean, me and Paul played about 25 acoustic guitars on that song. So when it gets to the chorus...
There are that many guitars on the song.
Acoustics.
Yeah.
So this is an old... I won't go down this tangent forever. This is an old Crosby, Stills, and Nash and Young trick that Paul Worley knew, where you kind of, if you have like up to 20 to 30 acoustics, it makes it feel like the whole song chugs along really
like
well.
Like the wall of sound.
It's like a wall of sound, right? So if you notice on the chorus, there's just this jing, 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 straight kind of thing, and that's about 25 acoustics in the background. I mean,
can
Paul
you not
Worley.
Can you duplicate them though? Is it not the same?
It's not the same. If you want to. In today's world, you could just duplicate them, yeah. But to have different guitars with different woods and different strings from different eras and different times, all surrounding in stereo, 25 different guitars, all playing. And, you know, Paul plays a little different than I play, and I play a little different and finger some of the chords differently with different voicings. But just those little nuances on the track. When Paul Worley got and dug in with that song, I mean, I got to give it to Mike Rojas. The piano stuff is amazing on that song, and I got to give it to Paul Wehrle, man. He is such a champion for great art, and he takes his time with it, and that can be hard with patience in the studio because we all want to just pump out a track in one day, but Paul will sit on it and work on it and work on it, and then 2 months later, you're like, wow, this thing sounds timeless.
So you write it, and you think, it's a song. Then it's sitting there, and you think, oh, this is a song. You
right.
cut it.
Right.
When do you realize that it could be special?
Once we cut it and we started showing it to people. So we recorded it and we started playing it for, you know, our friends. I mean, I wasn't married at the time. I wouldn't say my wife, but friends and people at the label and management. And they're like, man, that's like, that could be really a crazy cool kind of first single. And we're like, no, we need to have a tempo. Isn't that what you're supposed to do? You're supposed to have like the rockin' tempo as your first song. And they were like, man, it just, this feels like a piece of art. It feels like art. And we were all about it. We just thought it would be the album track, but we were all about it. I mean, it was my, it was all of our favorite song that we had recorded for the Need You Now, for that record.
So you have the song and it goes to country radio first.
Right.
And it splashes.
Yeah, it does.
At what point do you realize that the splash is bigger than what we expected it to be?
So we started getting calls. I mean, to this day, nothing will ever happen like this ever again. It just won't. The stars aligned. I mean, we started getting calls from every format and then all around the world. I mean, literally, I'd have to pull up the emails. I remember emails from like, hey, there's this, you know, the people in Italy heard it. People in Romania heard it. People in Russia and Australia and Japan. All these people all around the world want to start spinning the song. And I was like, what? Like, how did the, you know, I mean, it literally spread like wildfire. I mean, country radio, it went to number one for 4 or 5 weeks and stayed there for 4 or 5 weeks. And then we sent it to pop radio, you know, which we caught a little flack for. People do, you know, when you kind of cross over or send a song out to a different format and stuff. So I get that. But it went huge. It just went massive.
I played it at pop radio. I remember when the song came.
Yeah.
And that's when I remember when that band with the crazy name was the band of the song that we're playing at pop.
Right.
At what point did it feel like this is a whole new ball game?
It's a whole new ball. I mean, the international stuff, Canada and Europe, it took off in Canada and Europe. And we started getting requests to, you know, play in London and play in Toronto and go play in Australia. I mean, that was like, for me, we felt like the little kids from the country who get to go play in the big cities all around the world.
Did you get lost in that? Was it so much in a quick beat, or did you actually were you able to dissect it a bit and enjoy it?
That's a tough one. That's a really tough question. There's definitely parts that we didn't dissect. I mean, we didn't have anything to gauge it off of, so it was all happening for the first time. You know, it's like whenever, if anything ever happens and something takes off, you don't know what to gauge it against. This had it never happened before.
Did you reach out to anyone who had crossed over inside the... That's always what I wonder, because there are a few that had crossed over inside the format that you say, hey, I'm going into the pop world or the hot AC world.
Right.
You know, what are the things that happened to you that I don't expect? Did you have any...
We didn't have anybody, I guess. I mean, our manager, Gary Borman, did a great job at the time we were with Gary Borman, and he did a great job of having a lot of experience with a lot of pop acts, and also Keith Urban. He represents Keith Urban. And Keith had a lot. He has a lot of music that really goes around the world. I don't know if people really realize how big he is in Europe and Canada and Australia and stuff. So he had some experience with Keith, with a lot of international success. But it was just the three of us kind of strapping on for and holding on for dear life. I mean, it was a wild, crazy ride. It's so hard. You know, I watch people on TV now that go through these things. You know, when we were at the Grammys too, I'm watching Alicia Cara and all the new artists, and you know, when Sam Hunt was taken off, and then you know, you watch all these acts and Stapleton, what he's going through, and whoa, it's crazy. I mean, it's insane.
Are the asks all the time?
It's all the time, and you kind of lose yourself in that because you think you're supposed to say yes to everything, and you do say yes to everything. And I mean, I remember a vivid moment. Taylor Swift was about a year ahead of us in country music. She won New Artist of the Year at the ACMs and the CMAs. She was kind of like a year ahead of us winning a lot of the new stuff when she was coming out in country. And I just remember watching her and her trajectory and how much she just killed it and kept going and kept going. And I think we hit a point. So we, after the night of the Grammys in 2009 or 2010, I forget the year, where we won for record and song
three,
of the year.
Right?
We won five in one night.
You won five that night?
For Need You Now.
Wow.
I mean, song of the year.
Song, record.
And single. Was single one of the Grammys? No. There were a few country ones and then a few of the all genres.
So you won the three country ones that I'm thinking of. Okay.
And then the two all genres.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, like, I mean, it was crazy, dude. Live Your Life by Rihanna was in that category. You know, New York, New York by Jay-Z was in the category.
Were you getting people in the spectrum of not country going, hey, I love that
yeah.
song?
Oh,
and
yeah.
To you, it was like, whoa, you
oh,
even
yeah.
know who we are?
Yeah, I mean, like Lady Gaga came up that year, and some of the guys from a couple of the other big bands. But yeah, you get some of the like hip-hop artists. John Mayer, we met John Mayer for the first time. I loved your interview of his, by the way.
Thanks. Yeah,
really cool. Because I grew up in Georgia. I loved his history in Atlanta with Clay Cook and stuff.
Which is the whole Clay Cook thing is crazy too.
It's crazy.
Yeah, the whole. It's, for those who don't know, Clay is now with Zach Brown.
Yeah,
and Clay is awesome.
I love him.
But him and John were together.
I
as
love
a duo.
It all. Yeah.
And Christian Bush was in a few days ago. There's one that just went up. And you know, Christian was in the John scene in
yeah,
Atlanta.
Of course.
And they know
Eddie's
each other.
Attic. The whole.
Yeah,
I mean, circle.
Christian was the first band to ever play Eddie's Attic, and that's where John kind of came up.
Yeah.
But again, we're nerding on something different.
No, I know.
Was there a part of you, and again, I'm just jumping a bit.
Oh, but wait, let me finish that thought real quick, just because I was going to say, we as a band, I think, made a conscious, I didn't mean to cut you off,
no,
if that felt
please
rude.
Do.
But we as a band, I remember after we won all those Grammys, everything came in, go play around the world, do everything. I remember thinking, the three of us discussing, because, you know, we were like, I don't want to lose myself. I don't want to work that much. You know, we kind of hit this point in our career where we said we could work 365 days a year because there's enough stuff that's coming in right now that we could. But I don't want to. You know, I want to work and play 150, 200 shows, you know, do radio, do some great fun things and record. But I don't want to work every day of the year. And so everything came in where we could have lost ourselves in it. But I would say between the three of us and the perks of being in a group, you're able to have conversation with each other and work through things together. And we kind of said, you know what, this is amazing, this success. Let's keep it going with as much as we can, but not at the sacrifice of ourselves.
So where my mind goes, you're telling the story, is that instead of thinking how amazing this is that something great happens, how in the world do you follow that up? Because nothing's mm-hmm. ever going to follow that up.
Nothing.
Nothing.
It was a perfect storm.
So,
you know,
what do you put out after when it doesn't do the same? Do you feel like a failure, even though it's doing amazing, relatively to everything else except that one lightning in a bottle?
I mean, I can't ever use the word failure. I mean, everything that we've done in music, I just feel lucky that we get to do music, honestly. So that was just beyond any wildest expectation. And it was just a rare moment. I mean, you know, because it's also the first time somebody hears about it. I mean, imagine the first time you hear about a band, too. There's kind of that, you can't get enough of it. I mean, the first time I heard about, you know, Haim, this, you know, pop trio, I was like, oh, my God, I watched every YouTube
right.
you could possibly watch, which I love them and obsessed with them. Female pop group that's out now.
The three singers.
The three sisters.
Everybody wants to know how to spell it, but yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
I don't know if I said it right. That's how I say it.
I don't either. And when you said, this is how I know you're smart. When you said GIF, that's how people that really know say it. But the rest of us say GIF. And so all the term now with the normals,
right.
us, not you, us, the normals, the down below, we everybody says GIF. But when someone says GIF, you know they really know what
that's
the answer is.
That's how you
is.
Knew.
That's how I knew, yeah.
I didn't just come to play today.
Yeah,
this is real.
So Need You Now crushes it.
Yeah.
Well, what's the next single if it's country radio?
It was American Honey, which was
a
huge.
A successful song.
It was huge.
But was there a bit of... Huh, I wonder if this one will cross over because it was so big the time before.
Yeah, of course. Of course. I mean, absolutely. I mean, it's hard. It's really tough. You put all this pressure on yourself.
I've driven myself crazy.
Yeah.
Did you tell them the story? I'm going, oh,
yeah.
I'm insane about halfway through the ride because I'm going, the next ride, I got to start building
If I knew what I knew now about my personality type and everything I've learned about myself in the last 6 months at, you know, counseling and on-site and everything, oh my gosh, I would have, it would have been... It would have been helpful to know that much about myself, but maybe I'm grateful I didn't know as much about myself. And I just, we kept our foot on the gas and just kept going. But yeah, I mean, we ran into that for the next record. I think for the following record, but those songs did well at country. We had Just a Kiss and We Own the Night, which came out on our third record. But I don't know. Then we started asking, I think we hit a point where we started second guessing ourselves. you know, which all led into, I mean, you know, if anybody knows our evolution and our journey, you know, leading into, you know, we had some songs, maybe people don't know about them because they didn't work, but we had a few singles at radio that didn't do anything. Goodbye Town was a struggle for us. Freestyle didn't really work. Hello World was really a struggle.
And why do you think those were a struggle? What moved?
Well, at that point in time, I think some Lady Antebellum fatigue began. I really do.
Too much?
I think there's too much Lady A. Too much, you know. And it's just a natural cycle. I get it with anything. Sports teams that always win. I mean, we had won a lot, and our songs had been all number ones for a while. And then, you know, you get to a point where if the song isn't maybe as special, it's like, well, we've already heard that style from them. We get what they do. So there were a couple misses for us. I mean, that kind of led into, I think, some second guessing for us as Lady A. We kind of started to lean more on the business side of like, well, we got to get some hits again, guys. And then we just like, what happened to us when we made music that we didn't care about, where we lived in Josh Kelly's house and we wrote I Run to You and we wrote Love Don't Live Here and we wrote Need You Now? I mean, what happened to that? You know, how did we get that? And those songs came about because we weren't thinking. And then we went into a period of our career where we started thinking too much, I think. And I think anybody that probably hits 7 years, 10 years, 15 years, and there's been a lot of great people in this seat on your podcast that probably would say the same thing. There's just ebbs and flows. And you get to that point where you lose a little bit of what got you where you are.
Do you feel like you got some of that back or all of that back or a different back for Heartbreak?
I think we got it back. I really think we got it back. I think we said that we got it back on some earlier records. But, you know, we obviously had a break, had some time away. Different projects were out. Time to just kind of reconnect with who we are. And I think for Heartbreak, living together was just such a fun experience making the record. That helped us get it back. I mean, to like wake up and, you know, laugh and make coffee and, you know, I mean, living together, you're a part of every little facet of each other's lives. And it made us laugh again and made us feel young and made us, I think, write innocent music again.
I want to play something here and you'll know it, but well, something I pulled out.
All right. A deep cut.
Never alone. Never
so this is Never Alone, Jim Brickman. And this is the first time that you guys were on something together?
Right.
So this was this song actually was on the Hot AC chart, if I'm right.
It did pretty well. It's, yeah. I mean, a really impactful lyric and moving song, too.
So tell people who Jim Brickman is.
Yeah, Jim Brickman's an instrumentalist, piano player. And we were writing a lot with Victoria Shaw early on, and him and Victoria Shaw were good friends. And they said, Jim's looking for a featured vocalist for this song, Never Alone. And Hillary killed the song. It's a perfect fit for her. She's so believable in this song.
It was the first time Lady Antebellum was recognized as Lady Antebellum.
It was. Before we had a record deal. Before, yeah.
So what do you do on this song?
I just sing some harmonies.
Yeah?
Charles just sings some harmonies. It was mostly Hillary. Mostly Hillary singing lead.
Was it kind of cool?
She wrote the song. Hillary wrote that.
Oh, she wrote the lyrics?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Hillary wrote that with Victoria Shaw and maybe somebody else. Please forgive me, somebody else, if you hear this. And I can't remember who it was. But yeah, so Jim Brickman was looking for a feature vocalist.
That's got to be cool to see your name on something.
It was awesome.
You're a real entity whenever you're on. Lady Antebellum is on something.
To see, you know, when it's dark at night and you're in your car and the, you know, the radio letters, you know, they light up scrolling across. I mean, to see like, you know, when it goes across, Jim Brickman featuring parentheses or whatever, Lady Antebellum. I mean, I'll never forget it. I mean, that was amazing. That was before we had a record deal, too. Victoria Shaw really was a huge champion for that song. She was a producer on our first record, and that was a big moment for us.
You talk about being a songwriter. Aside from any of the Lady A stuff. Luke song, real yeah. Yeah. Who'd you write this with?
Me, Charles, and Luke. We had no fun that day.
Yeah, I bet. sounds like a terrible day. So, with songwriters, and I've gotten to know a lot of them on a much closer level because of doing this. This has been a great environment for me to get to know people and to get to ask questions I would never ask in my life. And I've also learned that with some songwriters, when they tell stories about their big songs, they have to almost have revisionist history because they write so many songs.
Yeah.
And they don't remember, but they have to have a story because someone goes, tell me when you wrote The House That Built Me.
Right.
And if you don't have a story, it kind of lets people down.
Right.
So when I say, do you remember the day?
Of course. That was the first time we'd written with Luke. We had known Luke Bryan, and we had talked about writing. I mean, we were all like on our first record and stuff. And, you know, he called us out to his house. He's like, dude, if you guys want to come over and write. And he's a really awesome and chaotic guy. And I just remember it being so like, you know, there's just so much going on in his world. He's got such a awesome, crazy family that's all over the place. And we show up, and so it was loud inside. And so we came out onto the front porch, and we sat on Luke's front porch. I mean, it feels like one of those classic like country moments, you know, but like we sat on Luke Bryan's front porch and had two guitars and wrote this song. We wrote another one, but this one was definitely like an amazing one. And what we wrote it with him, and he had some of the verse stuff going. And we really, I mean, I have to give Luke credit. He had a lot of this song in pieces, like a puzzle. Like, I've got this melody, man. You know, I've got this kind of thing, this idea. You know, I just think the lyric is brilliant. He had the some of the lyric. And we really, me and Charles helped him finish the song. So any songwriter would tell you, there's always kind of like, and it's different. Like, some write, I'll be there, and it'll be like, dude, I got this whole track, and I got this title. And then there's always like somebody that has a little bit more. And Luke had a lot of this kind of ready to go. And so me and Charles were there to help him finish it, come up with the bridge, finish some of the lyrics. And I mean, we loved it because it was the first time, it was his first number one, his very first number one. It was the first time I'd really heard him on a ballad that was moving. It felt really moving to hear Luke, you know, because he's such a lot of his tracks are big party songs, but I like the ballads he does. I mean, Drink a Beer. You know, for Luke, I love ballads kind of more than anything.
Yeah, so do I. I do too, because that you feel them.
We record so many ballads. We've always talked about, should we just do an album of like the ballads? I mean, we just love.
Do you remember the commercial when we were younger? Because we're same age relatively, where you'd wake up at 1 a.m. and it was like, now for $9.99, love songs. Yeah. And it was, how am I supposed to live without you?
Yes.
And it would go, Richard Marx and Luther Vandross.
They just scroll down.
It would
down.
Scroll the whole time. And then the one that they were singing would be in white, yeah. Highlight, and then it would change.
Those, God, we got stuck on the bus last year. I think we'd had a couple whiskeys. But we were all just like, this is the greatest. And I think somebody in the band called and ordered it, you know? Like, they're such great little collections of music. But yeah, I mean, I would sit and watch those things scroll. And they're like 30-minute infomercials, you know, so they would just go on and on and on.
I caught myself in a rabbit hole of watching YouTube videos of 90s commercials.
What?
And I know. And that was one. I watched, I think, four different commercials of that series. Time Life. They're Time Life.
Okay. I forgot about
love
that.
Love songs of the 90s.
Time Life. Wow.
And again, I just remember, man. Tell me, how am I supposed to live with Tyson at the piano, just killing it, man. Right. Will you guys ever not play Need You Now?
Oh, no.
Okay, so that's it.
It's so fun to play.
Still?
It still is fun. I would imagine one day you get tired of it, but when the crowd responds that way, it's fun.
I asked because we had a show at the Ryman. My band, or my goofy band. We played the Ryman. We invited a bunch of people to come out.
Right.
And we had we flew Hanson in to play.
Oh yeah, y'all. It was a charity thing, right?
We do it for St. Jude every year.
Yeah.
So it's the Raging Idiots,
$1 million
show, and all. Yeah. We ask a bunch of Dirks.
Yep.
Everybody comes to play, and so I brought Hanson in, and they just really don't like playing Umbop. But
don't.
No. Both times I had to say because they're very nice.
Yeah.
They couldn't have been nicer.
Yeah.
But I remember Taylor coming up saying, "Hey, listen. We'd really love to do because everybody's doing two songs.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
We had Darius was out, Dirks came out, and everybody's doing two songs. And I said, hey, we'd really like to do this song instead. I said, great, why don't you do three songs then?
Right,
you have to do Umbop. Like the people,
right,
want Umbop.
That's what they want.
And people went crazy.
Yeah,
I was watching.
Oh, I'd lose
30-year-old women climb the side of stairs backstage to get a picture, and then they came up on the show and they didn't want to play it.
Oh.
And so I said, hey, would you guys just mind playing a verse and a chorus?
Yeah. I mean, I guess that song for them, though, happened at a much younger, maybe, you know, intersection in their lives. And maybe they're just, that was a weird time for them, maybe. But, I mean, we're all, like, you know, older. And, I mean, weren't they, like, teenagers, really young?
Yo, I think the drummer may have been, like, 9.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Anyways, I don't know. Darius does it really well, too. I mean, I think he's a great champion for always playing Hold My Hand, Let Her Cry,
always.
Only Want to Be With You.
Yeah.
You know, in addition to all his number ones at country. I think he's a good, we're touring with him this summer, which is fun because we're going to kind of collaborate some and come in and out. And you know, I mean, I love playing on those songs. I want to play on.
That's my Darius, my first ever radio interview when I was 17.
Really?
Mm-hmm. It was actually Darius. And so we've come up around.
He did it without the band or just?
I got, I was, again, my first ever interview as a teenager. I was about to start freshman year of college.
Wow.
And I was a huge Hootie fan. So I drove an hour and a half. I don't know if they were getting me Sony, Dean. I had no idea.
Right.
And I was scared crapless. And they said, hey, you get Darius. And I was like, holy crap. And I go and I was shaking. And he took the microphone and just held it and led me through the interview.
Wow.
And so we've kind of come up parallel. In our, we've both shifted formats.
Yep.
Naturally. Both got kicked back from it.
Right.
Then finally people said, okay, we believe you.
Right.
And so he's we've always been close.
Right.
And he's been just a great friend to me.
Yeah.
More than he's ever needed to be. He's come to flown on charity events. He drove in from Charleston to do the Ryman show.
Yeah, he's so kind, man. He really is so
kind.
He's
got some party stories, too. And I will always let him tell the party stories. I never want to tell the Hootie. But, man.
Right.
The Hootie party stories. and he says, and he said on the air before, when he finally writes the book, people are going to go, dang.
Yeah.
We heard that, you know, the Who used to party.
Wait you know, those guys, anybody in that era, you know, to preface it, I don't party a lot, but anybody in those eras, like, you didn't have social media, so you could just kind of party and go crazy, and there was, like, no repercussions, I guess, you know? Like,
he played the show, I got him, he came out during one of our, we were doing Purple Rain, and he came out and scared us, and we know he's coming out, he's like, I do this song, he just jumped on stage and started singing. I said, okay, cool, but we're going to make you do an extra song, and so I was a geek for Cracked Review, and then I said, hey, let's do Hold My Hand. And so we played it together, him and I up front.
Nice.
And it was that and Better Than Ezra. I had Kevin come out from Better Than Ezra. And we did Good and Desperately Wanting.
Yes.
Total really selfish.
Wanted.
Yeah. I remember running through the wet grass, falling. And I was like, I'm in heaven.
Yeah.
I'm in heaven. Yeah. To me, those are the songs when you're a kid.
Yeah.
And the artists from when you were a kid mean more than a superstar.
The 90s stuff too, man. Oh, that 90s rock. I mean, who didn't love that stuff?
Yeah.
I mean, all the Pearl Jam that was going on. Cracked Review, I mean, that was, I was obsessed. So obsessed with Cracked Review.
There was an album cut on that called Running From an Angel. And it was Running From an Angel, Running to the Devil, Devil. And I was talking to Darius in Austin. He came and did a charity event. I said, hey, dude, I haven't heard that song in forever. That was my jam. I used to go to high school football practice. And he goes, man. He goes, I haven't played that song in 10 years. And we're at the event. And he goes, I got this for you. They worked it up. And they played the whole song. Oh, man, I think I got an erection. It was amazing. It was amazing.
A toner.
I did.
A musical, a toner. That's what they call it in Pitch Perfect.
So you guys are going out with Darius. A toner, yes. that third one's coming out too now, huh? Pitch Perfect 3? That's out?
Maybe I should just at least leave my disclaimer that my wife is obsessed, and so I kind of enjoy them.
Lunchbox just went on a whole thing about how he loves Pitch Perfect.
They're kind of good, though.
That's what he said, too.
I mean, Anna Kendrick's fun to watch, too. She's a great singer, so.
You guys are out with Darius.
All summer. Yeah. Hillary's rocking. She'll be rocking, man. I mean, she was really, I'll give it to Hillary. She was, you know, like, guys, I'm ready to go back out. Let's plan another tour, another big amphitheater tour. So it'll be fun. We've never, like, really done, like, just kind of this co-headlining thing back and forth. So it's going to be cool.
Well, I got to say, I was looking forward to this because, like, you should be the lead talker.
No.
Man. Like this,
well, if you have like an hour, I can do like an
right
hour.
This has been fantastic. I didn't know what to expect because Charles has such a big personality.
Right.
And he's also the front man talker, too.
Right.
And I like Charles. And I get along great with Charles.
Right.
But, you know, you come in and, you know, you take your role and you go, yeah, when you need me, I'm here.
Well, I don't feel like I can, like, I'm hard in, like, in a 1 to 2 minute setting. It's just hard for me to get deep because I think I'm always thinking, you know, really deep, and so it's hard for me to, like, fully get there in a minute or two at radio. So
I hope you feel like you got there a bit here.
I totally feel like this was enjoyable. Thank you. My first podcast.
Look at that guy over here. Look at this guy, Dave Haywood. The unicorn.
The unicorn.
Never by himself. I never had a conversation until he came over to the house. And thanks for coming up the hill. Thanks for coming over to the house.
Thanks for having me. Seriously.
We've done an hour and 10 minutes or so.
Really?
It goes like that, huh?
Wow. That's awesome, man. Thanks for having me. Seriously.
Twice you went, huh? I've never been asked that. Oh, those are the rewards for me.
Yeah.
When someone goes, you know what? I hadn't thought about it that way. So I feel like this has been a good conversation.
Me too.
I learned a lot.
Me too, Bobby.
Look at this guy. Genius over here. Mike, anything you want to add? Yeah, me too, man. I'm completely satisfied. All right, Dave Haywood, go watch him and Charles and Hillary, Lady Antebellum, and Darius throughout the summer and Heartbreak. You may listen to this a year from now because podcasts live forever. Their newest album, After Heartbreak, it's called insert here, is amazing. I love it. It's probably my favorite new record. Wouldn't you agree? There's a lot of heart in this one.
So much
you really
action.
Found yourself as a band.
Right, again.
Yes. All right, well, we'll see you guys next time.